Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to today's Football Times, the first of the new year. And I am Stephen Scragg at the helm tonight, which always feels a bit edgy. Always feels like something could potentially go a little bit awry here. But it's okay, I've got some two good wingmen on my side tonight. We have the wonderful Gary Thacker, who's nursing a cold over in, I'm still presuming it's sunny Spain at this at the minute.
It was yesterday. Today it's been a bit cold, but because both me and the wife are suffering with a bit of a sniffle, we stayed indoors. So, yeah, it's warm inside anyway.
good stuff. And on the other flank, the Cody Gakpo of the podcast tonight is Mr. Paul McParlam.
Yeah, I think the Trevor Steve of the podcast might be better referenced.
I'll let you have that one. You can have the Trevor Steve.
Looking forward to tonight's conversation and discussion, because we always cover such a variety of topics in such depth as well. And kind of just wish all our listeners a very happy new year and all the best for 2023.
Indeed.
Oh, indeed, 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 indeed. Moving straight into it tonight. I think we've gone back to, you know, exactly what we were doing before Christmas. You know, the three of us will bring one topic to the table, plus something we're looking forward to in the, I don't know, the days, weeks, even in months ahead, as the case may be. And Gary's going to bring us the, you know, the topic we need to start with tonight. And you know, it's Gianluca Vialli.
Yeah, I mean, it couldn't be anything else good as a Chelsea fan. I mean, what a guy. You know, I was doing a bit of research this morning, looking at his record, you know, before he came to Chelsea. Afterwards. I mean, this guy scored goals everywhere. When he came to Chelsea, he was easily 30, might be 31, I'm not quite sure, but around that sort of figure. And most players, when arrive at that sort of age, you know, you think it's for an easy payday or wide down to the end of their career. But he was, I mean, I wish some of the players today had his sort of desire and passion and determination. I mean, it was a brilliant, person. As a footballer, his personality was brilliant. He didn't have tremendous amount of pace, but a lot of his pace had gone, but he still sort of led the line really well. At Chelsea, he won the FA Cup, he won the League Cup, Cup Winners' Cup, as a player and then as a manager afterwards. And it was fascinating today to see the fans with all the banners and at City, and even the City fans were sort of giving a round of applause for him as well. It's one of the players, when he's sort of, I think he's universally, not necessarily loved, but universally respected, a decent bloke, and as I said, a wonderful signing for Chelsea. When he came to Chelsea, and you think, you know, as I say, an Italian striker, is he looking for a last payday? But this guy wasn't. He was looking for a last bit of glory, and he got it just as a player, and then as a manager afterwards. And obviously, going back to his time in Italy, he won the Serie A with Sampdoria alongside Mancini, and then obviously, sort of at the Euros recently, he was in Mancini's coaching staff as well, so it sort of rounded out the cycle, you know, nicely. And he recovered from cancer once, but that insidious bastard of disease got him second time round. So, you know, as with many Chelsea fans, you know, I'm sure we're sort of mourning the passing of Gianluca Vialli, but also sort of remembering the great days, and he has some great days with him as well.
Oh, indeed. I think the line you've used there is universally respected. I know, I think Gianluca Vialli, across the span of his career and the teams that he played for, you know, he was just one of those players that kind of, I don't know, he swept through barriers, I think. You know, he was an extremely likeable personality. You know, you get some players that are very easy to dislike and some players that are just impossible not to like. And Gianluca Vialli definitely fell into the second category there. I think, you know, starting out at Sampdoria, having played for Cremonese as well, you know, I think we all became aware of him at Sampdoria, you know, and as part of the Italian national team. So even before going to Juventus, where, you know, that big megalith of a club, where you can understand kind of like, you know, players being, I don't know, brandished as being part of a team that, you know, I don't know, they're equally cursed and blessed in a way. They're equally liked and disliked in so many respects. You know, I think everyone loved that Sampdoria side, that team that won the title in 1991. you know, still the last team in Serie A away from Milan, Turin, or Rome to have won the Serie A title. You know, that iconic kit, you know, and such wonderful teammates. And you know, and it's another thing, being quite evocative, the loss of Sinisa Mihajlovic, who you know, turned out so well for Sampdoria as well. You know, I've been watching a bit of BT Sports coverage of you know, Galazzo this evening, and James Ritzage and James Horncastle did a, you know, if you can catch up with it at any point, a good 15 minutes on Viali that was truly excellent television. That's well worth catching up with if you can find it tonight. But Paul, you know, your thoughts on Gianluca Viali?
Yeah, I mean, pretty similar to what both yourself and Gary said, Steve. A fantastic footballer. And at the time when he joined Chelsea, kind of 95, 96-ish, you know, the influx of overseas players hadn't quite reached his peak by that stage. So there was a lot of press on him to succeed. And as Gary said, there were question marks had he come for the last payday. But he quite clearly, you know, answered those questions so clearly. And then, you know, took on the responsibility of becoming the manager, you know, when Chelsea required his services. And yeah, I'm like, yeah, I've got three overriding memories of him. One is, although he played for Sampdoria in that European Cup final in 92, but my first memory really is the 92 Euros, when him and Mancini were leading a young Italy side in that competition. I was just really impressed with their partnership, how well they played together. And then you mentioned, Gary, Euro 2021. I loved that shot at the end when him and Mancini are hugging each other. You know, you see that the bond, the friendship is there, that they still had a deep affection for each other, which is superb to see. And I mean, from a purely selfish point of view, 97-98 season, when we needed Chelsea to beat Bolton to stay up, and Viali scored Chelsea's first goal, and the whole Goodison Park chant, Viali, Viali, Viali. So amongst Evertonians as well, we owe that lad an eternal debt. But yeah, absolutely fantastic guy. And I was just reading some of the remarks about it. Brilliant obituary about him in the Times yesterday. And he wasn't just a footballer, he was an all-round person as well. He was almost like a footballing intellectual. And when he was asked by Esquire magazine in 1997 what he intended to do once he retired from football, he said, I'm going to train my mind in the morning by studying Latin and Greek, and train my body in the afternoon by riding, boxing and fencing. And I think that kind of sums up what type of guy he was. A sporting icon, but also a very, very clever, urbane bloke.
Can you just throw one memory before we move on? When he was player manager, we were in contention for the title with Man United, but we were always sort of five or six points behind them. And we lost a game. It was only four or five games left, and it was the basic title race was over. And he was interviewed on Sky after the game, and I can't remember who was interviewing him. Said, you know, is it over? And he said, no, of course not over. We've got five games left. If we win them all 25-0, and Manchester United lose, concede 85, got Arsenal. Awesome. And I obviously just, I'd laughed. I mean, at the time when you know, I mean, what else can you do in a situation like that? So, you know, I as you both said, a terrific guy as well as a terrific footballer.
Oh, most definitely. And his career, you know, he rode the peaks and troughs as well. You know, it wasn't always, you know, rosy for him. You know, there was a spell, you know, his first two seasons at Sampdoria, you know, weren't exactly goal-laden, 84, 85, 85, 86. He scored something like 9 goals across the breadth of the two seasons, which, you know, even though Serie A was a very difficult league in which to score, you know, hatfuls of goals in, that was still quite low for the era. But it was his exploits with the under-21s under Cesare Maldini that persuaded Enzo Biasot to lean towards him for the 1986 World Cup as essentially kind of like the backup to, you know, Alessandro Altobelli. But it was from 86 onwards, that eye of the storm, 86 to 92, he had this, I think every season he hit double figures as far as Serie A goals were concerned. And that, you know, was a stunning, you know, in an era of Baresi and Maldini and Bergami and all of these, you know, gods of defending. You know, this was an incredible record that he had. You know, and to win a couple of Coppa Italias, to win the Serie A title, a Cup Winners' Cup, losing a further final, reaching and losing a European Cup final with Sampdoria. You know, it totally, and then to be the world's most expensive player in the summer of 92 as well, as part of a, you know, an amazing kind of tit for tat where the world record fee was broken three times in one summer between Juventus and Milan. You know, it, it, and then kind of like even his first couple of seasons at Juventus, you know, were laced with difficulties, only for him to come good again as part of a Serie A title winning side again, 94-95, and then to depart Juventus as a winner of the Champions League. You know, it wasn't always, and then at international level as well, it wasn't always easy for him. You know, as Paul said, the 88 European Championships, he was fantastic, but you know, he was basically the backup player, you know, in 86 and 1990, you know, meant to be the big moment for him. You know, it wasn't quite to be. He was, you know, blessed with a degree of bad luck. You know, missed a pile of chances in the opening game against Austria, missed a penalty in the next game, hit the foot of the post, and then eclipsed very, very quickly by the goals of Salvatore Scalacci. But you know, that strength of character, you know, to come back from the disappointment of a 1990 World Cup that was meant to be in the palm of his hands, that ran away from him, to be part of that Sampdoria title-winning side in the very next season was the perfect riposte. Paul, any last thoughts on Vialli?
We could spend the whole programme talking about Vialli, to be honest. It's similar to the Pelé podcast we did a little while ago, Gary. You know, there's so much you can say about the guy. And as you pointed quite rightly points out, Stephen, it wasn't all glory. You know, he kind of showed his character coming through adversity at times, coming over disappointment both at club level and international level. And you know, I think the overriding sentiment of everyone is, you know, he lost his life at far, far, far too young an age. And you know, obviously, you know, football fans, both here in Italy, are really deeply upset by the loss. And also, the Italian Football Federation has lost somebody who could have been helping to guide Italy back towards qualifying for the next World Cup as well. So there's been a big blow to them as well, for someone who still had so much to offer the game of football.
Indeed. I think as well, it shows so much about how well he was thought of, even at Fiorentina. You know, there was an impeccable reception for him, you know, for a man who played in the black and white. That, you know, I think that says the lot. You know, if such a partisan division can be, you know, brought down, you know, for one evening at least, you know, this was the man that kind of like broke those kind of divisions and swept respect across the board, I think. Moving on to Paul's first topic tonight, and we're a bit closer to home.
Yes, well, I mean, the phrase sleeping giant, you know, it really is often overused. And I've kind of been following the fortunes of Plymouth Argyle this season, because if ever a club deserves the term sleeping giant, to me, it's Plymouth Argyle. It's quite well known as being the largest city in England never to have had a top division team. You know, population of Plymouth is nearly 300,000. That's just in the city alone. When you factor in the greater region of Plymouth as well, you're pushing near 400,000. So there's a massive, massive captive area there. And also as well, that area of Southwest England, I think, needs a team to be playing in the Premier League, because it's one area of England where kind of the most people who grew up in those areas have to end up supporting Chelsea, Man United, Arsenal, Liverpool, because there's no local successful team to support. And I just think it would be brilliant if Plymouth were able to capture that support if they got themselves up into the top flight, because I just think the potential of the club is absolutely enormous. And you know, and at the moment, they're really making strides in the right direction. If you look at their record at the moment, two seasons ago, Plymouth were languishing in League Two. Now the top of League One, they're 7 points clear of third place, they're in a really, really healthy position. Their home record's phenomenal. They've won 12 games out of 13. The home attendances are averaging 15,000 for home games at the moment, which is, you know, phenomenal for a League One team. Last season, they just missed out on the playoffs. Got 80 points, which most other seasons would guarantee your playoff position, but it didn't last season. They were just really, really unlucky. But they've recovered from it this season. They've recovered from the loss of Ryan Lowe, the manager, who left and took the job at Preston North End. They stayed with his assistant, Stephen Schumacher, from Merseyside, ex-Everton young youth player, but never played for the first team, but had a career, successful career in the lower divisions, who suddenly made a bit of a name for himself down there. He's kept the bandwagon rolling. The team's gone from strength to strength. And it's the right balance there of experienced players and young players. You've got a young goalkeeper called Michael Cooper, who's born and bred in Devon. So that's great, you know, for the local fans to have a local lad playing a goal for your side. They've got lots of strength up front. Ryan Hard used to play for Rangers. There's goals all around the team. And so they're just looking really, really strong at the moment. They've got one of the best stadiums, I think, in that division. It holds 18,000 now, Home Park. if you look at the redevelopment has been so tasteful because the iconic main stand, instead of knocking it down and building a new one, they actually just redeveloped the lower section of the stand. So the original structure is behind, still being used as a seating arena, but the front part's been completely modernised as well. It just gives a real nice balance between the old and the new in the stadium as well. So I'm all for, if you can keep an original structure in the ground, then keep it, just, you know, redevelop it, but don't knock it down for some, you know, a cut and paste type stand that seems to be the feature of so many stadiums these days. So I'm just absolutely delighted to see them doing so well at the moment. I think the one big concern they may have going into the second half of the season is, I think Morgan Whittaker, who's their top scorer with 9, has been recalled to Swansea from loan. And when you think, to be the loyalty it takes to be a Plymouth Argyle fan, when, you know, your nearest away game is probably at least a 3-hour journey there and back. I love some of the photographs last season when they were playing away at Sunderland, and the supporters were leaving Plymouth at about 3 in the morning to get to Sunderland for the kickoff. We're not going to get back until just the 3 the following morning. And they just turned out such fantastic numbers, you know, to support the team. There was 18,000 at Bolton yesterday, and I think 1,500 were Plymouth fans as well. So that's incredible support for the team that has not had a record of success for a very, very long time. So I'm really hoping that Plymouth can get themselves into the championship next season. I'm really hoping that they can maybe, you know, with some suitable investments, recruitment, and in particular, if they can stick with the manager, he doesn't get tented away somewhere. I'm kind of worried he might be offered the Everton job, you never know. And I just think it's brilliant for that part of the world, because I still have this idea that Cornwall, you know, which doesn't have a football league team, you know, it's a big rugby area. And if Plymouth were to become a Premier League team, you just think there's a whole county there that's desperate to support a football team that would get behind them. You know, Devon itself has never had a top flight football league team. So once again, there's a whole tranche of Southwest England, two massive areas geographically, that have never made it to the top level of football. When you look around the country, it's almost like an oasis where football hasn't managed to penetrate in the way it has in other parts of the country. So I'm really hoping for the club, for the city, for the county, and for the southwest of England that Plymouth can get themselves into the championship. And then if they get themselves there, who knows, 1 or 2 years with good preparation, with good investment, with good recruitment, you know, I would just absolutely love to see Plymouth Argyle playing in the Premier League.
Most certainly. I think that as a football club, I know it's a long way further along the south coast, but, you know, they've got to be looking, you know, towards the east, basically, along that south coast, and saying, well, you know, if Brighton can turn things around, so, you know, on the brink of dropping out the Football League, 25 years so ago, Bournemouth, who 17-point deductions, you know, on the brink of collapse. You know, even Southampton dropping down to the third tier, Portsmouth almost went to the wall. You know, they have to look at, you know, it's not like, you know, they are kind of blessed by, a sizable amount of, they've got examples of what can be done that aren't at least comparatively far away. You know, they do have that, I don't know, that inspiration to be able to do it. I mean, as a football club as well, it's not, you know, they've come close to the big times. You know, they've been tantalising the club sometimes. I mean, I remember, you know, mid to late 1980s, them threatening the playoffs, you know, from the second division for the first division. You know, that FA Cup semi-final in 1984, you know, they'd reached the League Cup semi-final a decade earlier. Paul Mariner was with them, you know, made the big breakthrough at league level with them. Tommy Tynan hitting goals galore for them, you know, former Liverpool reserve, never made it, but scored an absolute pile of goals for them. You know, so they've had, you know, in the they're not too massively distant past, you know, these little hints and tastes of potential glory. Gary, you know, that's a tough division that they're angling to get out of, though. You know, Sheffield Wednesday, who turned, you know, not Newcastle out of the FA Cup. Ipswich, who look like they've turned a corner. You know, Derby, that is a Derby County. Bolton Wanderers are kind of like part of that cluster of teams that have at least, you know, they are detached a little bit. I think there's about an 8 or 9 point gap between that top three who are, you know, angling at the minute as if they might kind of like have their own little private battle for automatic promotion. But, you know, that's, if Plymouth can climb out of that division, it's a hell of an achievement.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Paul says, you know, just come to Sleeping Giants, that they're sort of grouped in amongst some fallen giants, that, you know, the clubs you just mentioned there. I've always had a soft spot for Plymouth Argyle. I mean, when I was a kid, just first because of the name. It's, you know, it's one of those unique names in football, you know. I mean, there's Preston North End, you know, it's just Plymouth Argyle. And I always liked green kits as well. And I remember when I used to have Sabutio, I wanted to get a Plymouth Argyle. And I mean, this is true. Because they used to wear green with like a white, a bit like a Sampdoria shirt, but it was white, blue, green with black and white bands across the chest. I went to the shop and they bought this Plymouth Argyle. Great. I got it home and it was this blooming second kit. And so it was white with green and black. But anyway, I loved Plymouth Argyle, the kit. That was great. Now, I remember going back, you mentioned some of the old lads. I remember a guy called Norman Piper used to play for Plymouth many, many years ago. And he played for them in the 23s. It probably wasn't those days, rather than the 21s. And you see some clubs who are sort of, you know, they're sort of reach out beyond where people expect them to be. And it can't be sustained for a number of reasons. Now, Plymouth are in a really potentially advantageous position geographically, because although, as Paul says, kids glory hunting for success, glamour, wouldn't be supporting Plymouth. However, if they did start getting in the Championship and perhaps threatening to get into the Premier League, the latent support in that area for a club like Plymouth Argyle is absolutely massive, because, as Paul quite rightly says, they're sitting there alone. And without, I mean, other than Exeter, I mean, who else is near to them? Even, you know, in the sort of, you know, semi sort of big clubs. So, yeah, I mean, it'd be great to see a side like Plymouth. Yeah, and for the Southwest as well, as Paul quite rightly says, because they've never had the real success down there. That would be great. But I'd great to see where, if it sort of win the green kit again. That would be brilliant.
Oh, definitely. I think a lot of the neutrals, you know, rather than the fallen giants who've kind of contrived against themselves, I think yeah, the team coming up,
yeah,
you know, they'll have a lot of people on their side this season plugging for them. You know, it's a bit like the Bristol clubs, isn't it? You know, you look at certain areas of the country and think, you know, Bristol City, yeah, they had that 4-year span in the first division, late, you know, second half of the 1970s. But, you know, these little kind of like areas, well, not little areas, big areas with you know, football clubs that have underachieved, or, you know, the potential, you know, I mean, and that, again, it's one of those where, you know, in a sport and in a game where, you know, there's so much, you know, ownership from all over the world, you know, I'm amazed that, you know, someone hasn't kind of done the homework enough to scope out a team from one of these types of areas. You know, no, Carlisle, another one, when you're going further, yeah, you know, going towards the north, you know, it's you know, such a vast landmass and potential to, you know, to be the magnet of support. You don't have to look at Wrexham and the way that they've, you know, caught the imagination of the local area. And, you know, in an area where kind of like it's very easy to support Liverpool and Everton, you know, it's less so for people in Plymouth. You don't have to be from where you are to, you know, to support a football club. But at the same time, you know, I think it's when there's that geographical detachment, you know, I think it's even more, you know, the potential is there.
I think as well, Stephen, but what's really good about Plymouth is, I love the fact the sponsor is Ginsters, who make the Cornish pasties. So you've got the local connection there. They're not sponsored by like a Bessing company, which is really good. And secondly as well, a lifelong fan when he was alive was Michael Foot. And if Plymouth are good enough for Michael Foot, they're good enough for me.
Well said.
Oh, excellent stuff. Moving on to another team.
Michael Foot playing the left wing, that's a question.
It's safe on the inside, right?
Sorry.
Moving on to another team in green. I've been very pleased to see the rebirth of Panathinaikos. You know, they've lost today to AEK Athens, first league defeat of the season, but they're still maintaining a 4-point lead, seven ahead of Olympiakos. They've had a massively rough ride this season. It was the first time they've played European football in 5 years. Short-lived, so, venture into Europe, but still a venture into Europe all the same. They won the Greek Cup the end of last season, their first major trophy in 8 years. You know, that they are one of the iconic names of European football. You know, still to this day, the only Greek side, and likely to remain the only Greek side to play in a major European final. The 71 European Cup final that they reached against Ajax under Frank Puskas. You know, even then, you know, 85, 96, reached more semi-finals in the European Cup and the Champions League. You know, even down to the early days of the new millennium, you know, 2002, they reached the quarterfinals of the Champions League, 2003, the quarterfinals of the UEFA Cup. You know, we're talking about a team of massive substance here, and then suddenly, you know, the back in the game, and it's, you know, Ivan Jovanovic is the man behind her. He led Apoel to the quarterfinals of the Champions League. Well, Apoel, a decade ago, you know, won a set of jobs out east with Al Nassr, and then the United Arab Emirates job. And it was an amazing thing. Panathinaikos only gave him a year's contract last year. You know, that fragile of a football club, you know, despite everything he'd done, you know, no stranger to Greek football, Greek club football as well. And then suddenly here they are, top of the league, looking comfortable, you know, strong defence. And this isn't a team that's been built with, you know, they lost one of the star players in the summer to Sporting, headed off to Portugal. You know, we're talking a load of journeymen. You know, they've got a lot of, you know, a cluster of Spanish players who've, I don't know, they were talented youngsters that never quite fulfilled, you know, the potential. And they've just drifted off here, there and everywhere. And, you know, it's one of the great stories. It's 13 years, by the end of the season, it'll be 13 years since he won the last of the 20 Greek league titles. And, you know, it's, you're always looking for a comeback. You know, it's like, it's, you know, you look like the Elvis comeback 68. This has that kind of vibe to it. You know, great to see Panathinaikos fighting back. Paul, you know, you have a history with Panathinaikos.
We have a bittersweet history of Panathinaikos, as I recall. Yeah, I still remember that infamous, from the Everton perspective, the quarter final against Panathinaikos in 1971, where Everton obviously bashed them in the quarter final, conceded the goal, and ended up having to sneak a last minute equaliser to make it one each. And then in the away leg back in Greece, they just held on for a 0-0 draw, and that was it. And the ramifications of that defeat are still living on. And yeah, I mean, it's funny, isn't it, Stephen, that, you know, that no team from Greece has managed to qualify, has managed to reach the final of a European Cup stroke Champions League since that day, because the fan base is there, the passion is there. You know, I'm sure the finances must be there as well. So it is like a history of kind of, you know, extended underachievement. You know, for a team that historically is one of the major forces in Greek football. And yeah, you keep wondering, you know, when, although Greece has made at times an impact in international level, you think of the Euros in particular, 2004, it's at European club level, they haven't really made the impact that their support deserves. I mean, just looking at you know, you mentioned some of the players in their squad. I'm also quite astounded to see that ex-Everton player Bernard plays for them as well at the age of 36. And maybe this may be an indication of the issue that sometimes faces major Greek clubs, is the over-reliance on fading footballing stars who've come from other countries. For you know, we mentioned before about the concept of the last paycheck. You know, you look at James Rodriguez, who's now turned up at Olympiacos as well. So there are, you know, there are kind of precedents there as well. But you just think that, mate, wouldn't it be brilliant if the satellite TV companies took a gamble on showing Greek football for a change, or just like an end of season, you know, title decider or a Greek Cup final, just to give, you know, the average supporter an insight into what a passionate country that is in terms of football. Because, you know, I have to say, my knowledge of Greek football is really limited. I'm, as ever, Steve, I'm hugely impressed with your deep, profound knowledge of what's going on in Greek football there, because I don't think it's the country people go to first for their football diet. I think it's kind of just on the back burner there. You tend to stick with the major four European leagues in that respect, but, you know, it has huge potential. And yeah, I mean, it's great to see, you know, from reading your books about, you know, the three European competitions before the Champions League kicked in 92, about those great clubs from the past who had their heydays in the 60s, 70s and 80s. And it's just brilliant to see them come back again. So, you know, the clear at the top of the table at the moment, I really hope that they do manage to win the title and then come through the labyrinth Champions League qualifying process and get themselves into the competition itself.
Oh, definitely. No, Gary, it seems like Panathinaikos, there's still a place for them, isn't there? There's still a place, at least in the, I don't know, in the heart of football fans of a certain age.
Yes, definitely. Another team we played in green as well. I remember when I was writing my Ajax book, I managed to get in touch with a couple of Greek journalists to talk to them about Panathinaikos, and they gave me the sort of part history and about, you know, Puskas went there, and they said, you know, but in that final played against Ajax, it's just the Ajax team that dominated European football for 3 years. For a good hour of that game, and after, because Ajax scored quite early when Dijk scored with a header, and for about an hour after that, it was pretty even. You know, this team was no mugs, and you know, they sort of did Greek football proud. And it's strange that, you know, no Greek team has ever come through with that again, which just emphasises how exceptional that collection of players coached by Puskas was. And you know, it's interesting what Paul said about, you know, them not being on TV. And I guess that's probably the reason why most people don't know what's going on in Greek football. And I didn't. I mean, I'll be honest with you, I didn't. And, you know, I always imagined Olympiacos and AEK, you could flip a coin, it was going to win the league, and it would come down heads for one and tails for t'other. And Panathinaikos would be only winning if the coin landed on its edge. But, I mean, it's great to see a team with that sort of heritage come back and, you know, triumph again. And I just want, I hope that, you know, if they do get to win the title, that all of a sudden Jovanovic, the coach, isn't spirited away to some bigger opportunity, and they lose three or four players, and before you know where they are, they're back in mid-table again. Because you could just see that sort of, you know, it's a cliched, hackneyed phrase about modern football, but, you know, when you don't talk, it screams, and, you know, you just wonder if you want to see them, you know, have a good time at the top, but I just wonder if you know, they do have a success, you know, they'll end up with some of the players like Paul mentioned, you know, guys in for the last 3 or 4 years of their career, or a few journeyman players, and the stars get spirited away, and the coach, you sort of put the team together, is whisked away to, I don't know, Holland or Germany or France or somewhere. I don't know what he can earn more money, but yeah, it's a great story to see Panathinaikos back, and, you know, another team in green. Well done, guys.
Well, that's it. They can't stay a secret for long, can't they? You know, that's the problem there. But yeah, you know, as I pick up on what Paul said there, is it would be good to see these leagues tip up. I've often thought there'd be a market, if not for a league, then certainly for kind of like, I don't know, the most passionate games from each of these countries being broadcast, you know, picked off as individual games. You know, it'd be magnificent to see to say Panathinaikos AEK or Olympiakos Panathinaikos, you know, the biggest games in Turkish football. A couple of seasons back ago, I think it was during COVID, and BT picked up the last 3 or 4 months of the Turkish Super League season, and there were some fantastic games. Obviously lacking the passion of the support that would have been the, you know, the incredible backdrop to it all. But, you know, I think there is, you know, surely a, you know, an innovative, you know, a bit like when Channel 4 picked up Serie A in the early 90s, and, you know, but yeah, it's like, you know, even like the Belgrade games and all of that, you know, there are these utterly, I mean, you know, you Google it, kind of like the top 20, you know, most volatile derbies in the world. You know, let's see some of them on our televisions.
Dead right, buddy.
Absolutely, Stephen, absolutely. Let's get that petition going.
We'll have to set up our own CFT television station. See if Omar can pick up some cheap TV rights for us. Well, moving on to what we're looking forward to this week or coming up soon, we'll go full circle and back to Gary.
Yeah, it's not something I'm looking forward to. It's something I'm a bit concerned about. Well, more than a bit concerned about. I was hoping the FA Cup results this weekend would sort of give me a nice justification for the argument. And when Stephen scored a late equaliser at Aston Villa, I thought that was a perfect one. But then they went and scored again and ruined the story. Basically, what's happening next week, I think it's next week or the week after, the Premier League and the EFL, the Football League, are the big wigs getting their heads together about cutting down on fixtures. And the prime target, apparently, is FA Cup replays. Now, I mean, to me, you know, you look back at some of the great sort of cup upsets, and we were talking with Paul and Dave about the third round games a while ago, and the Hereford beating Newcastle one would never have happened if there wasn't a replay, because they drew the first game at St James's Park. And it's just, you know, a small club like Stevenage would have been a perfect example if they hadn't sort of ruined the story for me. Getting a draw at Aston Villa, taking Villa back to their own ground, it's a money spinner, and they've got a great chance of getting through. Well, actually, they got through anyway. But I think the idea of you know, diluting the FA Cup even more than they have done, it's just anathema to me. You know, it's the FA Cup, I was brought up with the FA Cup used to be as important as the league, and perhaps in many, perhaps even more important is the oldest competition. But it's got watered down and watered down and watered down so much now that it's just, you know, teams putting out young players. Like today, the Man City game, Man City-Chelsea game, reserves going out there. I'm sure it's happened across so many other fixtures with the bigger clubs. I just think it'd be a terrible thing to do, but I think I could see it happening because it's just an easy target.
It's 30 years now since they stopped multiple replays.
Yeah,
you know, and introduced penalty shootouts to decide, you know, one replay. I'm in a way amazed that it's taken this long for the FA to go in this direction. Paul?
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with Gary Shelby there. I mean, to me, what they've done with the FA Cup in terms of, you know, it's losing its significance and its impact on popular football and culture, for me, it's just bizarre because it's such a unique competition. It's such an historic competition. And they really have wasted the legacy of that competition provided, the stories, the history, the games, the knockouts, the unlikely heroes who were famous for 90 minutes, you never hear them again. And then you think about the FA Cup replay. I mean, to me, that's one of the unique selling points of the FA Cup, that, you know, if you're a supporter of a lower league team and you go to a Premier League team and you get a draw and you bring them back to your own ground, I mean, that's what, you know, you must remember from your younger days when you watch Walsall occasionally, Gary, that it was really a big thing if you got a draw against a bigger team and brought them back to your home stadium for the replay, an intimidating atmosphere. And suddenly in the town itself, people, you know, may have had so much of an interest in the local team, suddenly got interested in the team and had the knock-on effect for the team's benefits as well. Because I just find all the odds in the FA Cup at the moment, I know there are the odd exceptions, Stevens and Sheffield Wednesday have proven this weekend, but generally, the way the cup is structured at the moment is that the bigger teams will beat the smaller teams. And even if they don't beat them over 90 minutes, if there's no replay, they're going to beat them on penalties anyway. So, and more to me, you know, there's a real divide between what football targets as its origins. I think there's more and more a drive to almost forget the guy who goes to the match, the legacy fan, and target the TV audience. The TV audience loves the drama of VAR. The TV audience loves the drama of penalty shootouts. Whereas the average fan actually goes to the games, the match-going experience. They're missing it. They're not wanted apart from the backdrops for atmosphere. I know 30 years down the line, they're probably computer-generated atmospheres anyway. I just won't bother with football fans per se. But I think as an away supporter, you know, when you go to a cup replay and you get a draw, the feeling's brilliant, but you can't have that feeling because a draw doesn't count for the same thing if there's no replays, because you never go to penalty shootouts. You know, the odds are you go and lose. I think it's a real backward step. I can understand. And the complication is, you know, it's more the pressure from UEFA for the extended Champions League that's having the impact. I just think, well, why should the majority of clubs in the Premier League and EFL suffer so that a cabal of six or eight clubs that regularly qualify for these competitions each year can continue to enjoy the TV riches, whilst the rest of the clubs are squabbling around trying to get on that gravy train? And for lower league teams in the EFL, you know, I mean, it's the EFL, there's no league, there's no structure like it in the rest of the football world to me. I mean, look, I mentioned Plymouth Argyle's gate, 15,000. You check some of the gates in the EFL for Sheffield Wednesday, for Bolton, for Derby County. They're better than some of the games in top gates in Serie A, in Bundesliga, in La Liga. It's a rich footballing tradition. So, you know, I just really think it's a backward step. It's a negative step. And once again, it's money calling the shots and the football fan is just cast aside.
If I just chuck on the interview as well, I think there's something special about a midweek FA Cup replay. Yeah. Under the lights. Definitely. You know, yes, when the sort of first game, it can get lost in a mass of another 32 games. When there's only two replays, and there's one on a Wednesday and one on a Tuesday, you know, it's special. It's an occasion. And, you know, as Paul quite rightly says, if you're a lower club, lower division club, you pulled a big team down, the magic of that night, and, you know, as Paul said about when I was younger watching Walsall, I had a few of those sort of occasions at Walsall. Didn't always win, but it's, there's something special about night football under the footlights and in the early part of January and February as well. Something special that could be thrown away.
Well, definitely. I mean, even going back to, you know, the multiple replays, you know, they were just such epic sagas, yeah. You know, that would drag on for 3-4 games. You know, Liverpool-Arsenal in the semi-finals in 1980, sharing four games in about 12 days plus a league game. You know, it was, you know, an era you can't go back to. But these were kind of like the legends that the competition was built upon. You know, I can kind of get it in some respects. You know, there's been occasions where, you know, a smaller team, you know, gets a draw in the first game and then is blown away in the semi-final. In the replay, you know, I'll towards maybe something like a Chesterfield against Middlesbrough. in 97 when it ended 3-3 and they were from 3-1 up. You're throwing the question there, what might have happened had it gone to a penalty shootout? Would we have seen Chesterfield reach the cup final? You know, there are occasions where sometimes, you know, they do get that one shot, you know, and the replay is eventually, you know, it's boosting the finance of the club, which again is no bad thing. You know, that's no bad thing for a, you know, it's much needed revenue for clubs as well. Because they've already kind of like chipped away and eroded at it so much, you know, for me it's kind of like, you know, it would be lovely to go back, but they're not going to. But I think losing that one replay that we've got is, you know, it's a detrimental thing to the competition. But within that, you know, there's a wider discussion to be had, is that, you know, are we wrong in having two cup competitions, two domestic cup competitions? You know, we've set our landscape out, our domestic landscape out, at a time when European football, you know, had less demands to it, you know, and as it is now, you know, even if you're playing in the Conference League, you know, I think to go all the way, you'd still be playing what, upwards of 12 or 13 games to do that. You know, it's a sad situation.
It is sad, yeah.
Moving away from English football for at least for the moment, Paul, there's moving towards Gary's homeland.
Yeah, very much so. I'm sure Gary has been following this as well, but I've just been fascinated by what's going on in La Liga 2 this season, because before the games kicked off this evening, there were 7 points separating the top team, Las Palmas, from the team in 10th place, Cartagena. Now, at the moment, if Eibar win their game tonight, which is taking place as we speak, and they're winning 1-0, they will go above Las Palmas at the top with 40 points. So there's still going to be 8 points separating the top 10 teams. And I just think that's an intensely close competition to get the... No, to be get the two automatic promotion places and to be in a position to get the to be able to have a chance of being promoted via the playoffs as well. And I think it's what's fascinating to me about that league is that some of the, we mentioned before about the fallen giants concept in League One, Bolton, Sheffield Wednesday, etc. You kind of got that in La Liga Dos. You got Racing Santander near the bottom three. You got Real Zaragoza, who Stephen's written about in detail for his European Cup Winners' Cup boot. You got Gijón, Oviedo, who from when I was growing up with traditional sides in the top Spanish division. Malaga, who've also been a top Spanish side as well. But they're more towards the lower half of the league than the top half of the league. So there's a really kind of interesting split there as well. And, you know, we talked before, you know, about the potential. And, you know, it's... Las Palmas are stumbling a little bit now, but I think people kind of have this image of Las Palmas that, you know, it's kind of like a beach with a football ground behind it, where, you know, nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, the population of Las Palmas is 380,000. I mean, it's the 10th largest city in Spain, so there's a massive, massive appetite there, you know, to support their local football club. And I remember chatting to a taxi driver in Las Palmas about the local derby between Tenerife and Las Palmas. And here's me naively thinking it'd be some friendly thing, you know, all the islands together. And he was like, oh, no, it's awful. You know, we dread going across the Tenerife. It's a nightmare walking from when you dock on the boat towards their ground, because their ground's right in the city centre behind all these side streets. And you just get attacked and get things thrown at you. So I said, well, what happens if they come here? So it's better organised here. So I stayed outside the ground and they got bushed to the stage and bus back again. So it's a different experience altogether. But the passion that was coming through in that conversation was so intense. You could just see how much football means. And you look at some, you know, the other teams there as well. You've got Levante trying to get themselves back after being relegated last season also. You've got as well Alaves, also pushing to get back as well. So it's a really, really intense competition at the moment. And it's, you know, it's kind of surprised me the names that, you know, turn up there as well. I mean, I was quite surprised, you know, when it's the Panathinaikos squad, see Bernard was playing there. I was stunned to see ex-Everton player Sandro was playing for Las Palmas, and his race is really, really high there because he's a local lad who's gone back to Las Palmas where he grew up to play for his hometown team as well. So I think that's... As that season develops, it's going to be absolutely fascinating to see whether two teams can pull away to get the automatic promotion places, whether some of the fallen giants get themselves re-established. I know Zaragoza have put a bit of a winning run together at the moment, so they're moving up the table slightly. And whether, you know, it goes down to a nail-biting finish. I mean, because remember last season, you know, it'd be interesting to see which teams make the playoffs, because in the playoffs last season, Las Palmas played Tenerife, and Tenerife won to get through to the final. So, it, you know, that won't happen again this season because Tenerife are so far down the table. But it's really, it's, you know, you could get an all-Bas playoff game between Eibar and Alaves, which would be really fascinating to watch as well. So it's we talked in this program before about the championship and how, you know, every game's got something at stake. I think the same can be said for La Liga DOS at the moment, because certainly those top 10 clubs are all in with a realistic chance of promotion. And it's going to be intriguing to see how that plays out for the rest of the season. So if you don't follow La Liga, no, La Liga 2, just keep an eye on it, because there's going to be some twists and turns. And I'd love to come back to us at the end of the season in our final pod of the season and just discuss how it all worked out.
The Segunda over here is traditionally always close. To have seven or eight clubs fighting for the two automatics and the four playoff places is the way it always works going into the last two or three games. I say always, but invariably that's the case. It's interesting you mentioned about Eibar. I mean, Eibar are an amazing club. The town you mentioned about the population of Las Palmas, and the town of Eibar is in the Basque Country. You could fit the population of Eibar into the San Mamés Athletic Club's stadium in Bilbao twice over and still have a third of the capacity left. That's how small Eibar is. And I mean, you look at the ground, it looks like a conference ground. But they have done amazingly well to be in the to stay in the Primera for so long, but they got relegated last season. And even then, they got relegated the last couple of games. So that would be at all surprised they come back. Alaves as well, they've got pedigree for being in the top league. It's interesting, I just want to mention about sort of fallen giants. I'm going to go down from the Segunda to the Tercera, the third tier. And there's a club there playing who, one of the fallen giants of Spanish football, Deportivo La Coruña. And they're facing relegation from that division. This guy I used to play for you, Paul, Lucas Forward.
Not Lucas Perez.
He
went to Arsenal. We were supposed to be signing him, but he chose Arsenal instead.
Oh, no, sorry. That's what we were thinking of. Somebody, I think he played for you. Anyway, he was playing for Cadiz in the Primera. Basically, he's from La Coruña. And because his team, his hometown team, was struggling, he spent 50,000 euros of his own money to buy himself out of the contract so he could go to play for Depor to help to rescue the club. I thought it was a wonderful little story. It was picked up in one of the Spanish papers this morning. That's you know, there's a guy who believes in, you know, wants to take something back to his hometown club. But Depor fought to the fallen giants. My word! I mean, you know, I remember I wrote a piece a while ago when they beat AC Milan, something like 5-1 or something in the European Cup. But yeah, so lower league Spanish football is quite competitive, especially the Segunda, for promotion and even relegation. I mean, you know, you get teams that can be sort of there's two teams that's going to be, it definitely guarantees going to be in the top three or four, and there's two teams you can guarantee going to be in the bottom. Anybody else in that league could be anywhere.
Oh, going back to Depor there, I mean, it was 2004, I think it was, they reached the semi-finals of the Champions League. You know, their fall from grace is absolutely stunning. You know,
yeah,
and sad to see. Said earlier about falling giants, and that you tend to try, or I do at least, try to favour, you know, the upcoming team. And then when you talk about Plymouth Argyle early on, and, you know, the big team's kind of like blowing it, and you've had your chance there. But, you know, I think there are, you know, instances on the other side of that coin where you do see a fallen giant, and you do want them to fight back. Certainly if they've been away for a certain amount of time, and Depor's time away from the top, from the limelight is, you know, stretching ever further away. But going back to the Segunda, I mean, one of those sides that are in the mix for that is FC Andorra, which are probably a topic in themselves. You know, yeah. Gerard Piqué, you know, his team, who have gone from, what, the sixth tier to the second tier in the blink of an eye, inclusive of buying one promotion effectively from, I think it was Reyes, who couldn't pay the players, thus forfeited their place in the third tier, I think, you know, two or three years back. And effectively, you know, FC Andorra bought, you know, their place off them for the third tier. So, you know, they went from fifth to third, you know, in one summer. And then, you know, this is their first season up in the second tier, and they're up there in the mix of it, just on the outskirts of the playoffs. But, you know, they're in with a shout, you know. So there's a touch, I don't know, almost a touch of the Monzas about them, you know, in the way that they've risen from the lower divisions with a little bit, you know, somewhat wind assisted though. So it's one of those feel good stories that isn't maybe quite what it seems, but yeah, they're an interesting one to keep an eye on as well in the coming months, as Paul said, towards the end of this, what should be an incredible season, I think.
And just one final thing on Daypole. I mean, it's incredible to think that back in the 90s, they were attracting like a Bebeto, a world major Brazilian World Cup star, to play for them, you know. And you look at the fall from grace since then. I mean, I don't know the full details of what's gone on there, but I'm assuming mismanagement, catastrophic investments. But yeah, poor recruitment. And you know, Galicia needs, you know, a rival to Celta Vigo. They need a strong team up there as well. So yeah, really, really sad to see. And you can just see, you know, examples in English football where, you know, we mentioned both once before, you know, really iconic club from the, you know, from the post and pre-war times as well, and you know, suffering hard times. You know, yeah, it's just a, as you said, Stephen, you know, you always have a degree of sympathy for a fallen giant that's you know, now suffering difficult times. And part of you thinks, you know, I might not like them so much within the top division, but I'll tell you what, it'd be good to see them come back again.
Oh, indeed. I think Depor are quite evocative team as well, aren't they? I mean,
yeah, you know, the kit as well. Yeah.
Going there, and it's that kit. Yeah. The Riazzo and the way that, I mean, they eventually filled the ends in the stadium, but it used to be like a clam. There was no ends, and you could see the Atlantic at the far end, you know, footage of the 82 World Cup, and that was what the stadium was like. You know, it wasn't boxed in, and it's literally on the ocean, virtually, that stadium. But yeah, I mean, you know, winning the title, you know, in 2002, Juanfran, and you know, incredible side that they had. You know, the last new champions in Spain. You know, no team since then has been first time champions. And I think they became, I think still to this day, the ninth Spanish, you know, league champions. You know, and that's the thing in Spanish football, is the number of league champions is so low. You know, and you know, I don't know. I think, you know, Spanish top flight football needs all its champions up there, you know, and within the other side of that is that, you know, in La Liga itself, Sevilla are still next to bottom and really, really kind of like looking like they're struggling to find their way into their campaign.
Yeah, I think they won today. I think they're, but the strongest club in the Liga at the moment in the Primera is my local boys up the road from me, Elche, who have, They've got 4 points from 4 draws. God knows how they got the draws. I mean, we watched them play. I mean, it's great to have a local club there, because we get to Elche pretty regularly. I've seen Barcelona play there, Real Madrid, Sociedad, Betis, Sevilla. They have really gone through the ringer this season. I think they're on the third manager. I mean, I was watching the game on the TV, and I think it was on Friday, and I thought, who's this guy? I mean, I looked him up on the thing, another new manager. They're in catastrophic trouble.
Well, coming back full circle as the Premier League kicks off again after the break for the FA Cup, I was just idly looking at the bottom end of the Premier League the other day, and you know, just how much of a potential demolition derby the relegation battle is going to be. I mean, we're only effectively just over a third of the way into the season, but this is the time where it, you know battles like that begin to take shape. And I just took an idle look at where it was sat this time last season, in comparison, and the gap this time last season between 18th and 13th was 10 points, and this season it's sat at 2 points. There's 2 points split in Everton in 18th and Leicester in 13th. This time last year, Norwich already looked relegated on minus 34 points. They were adrift at the bottom. The three that eventually went down were within the bottom four at this point already last season. So, you know, that shape is already, you know, there. You know, it's forming itself. But I think the fact that it's just so concertinaed, we don't have an obvious Norwich. Nottingham Forest were kind of shaping themselves to be the Norwich of this season, but have suddenly kind of, you know, an FA Cup exit yesterday aside, you know, they've suddenly found the voice. You know, I think it's going to be an absolute mess down there. And, you know, that's not just like a clanging doom of, you know, a bell of doom for Everton there. That's kind of like across the board. You know, there's a lot of teams down there. You know, Leicester themselves, just 2 points clear, and only a year or two on from winning the FA Cup and threatening a Champions League place. the way it's shaping up at the minute, you know, denotes that there might just be a big casualty come May. Your thoughts? I'll come to Paul first, and that's not out of any kind of, you know, poking with a stick there, Paul. You know, I am hopeful. I can actually see a landscape where Everton do, you know, pull away from this. I don't think Frank Lampard's going to last much longer, but I see a path to salvation that might not be the prettiest to watch, but you know, I can see them taking a pragmatic, you know, approach to the last 3 or 4 months of the season that'll drag them out of it. But you know, your thoughts on this, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, two main points, Stephen, to kind of pick up on what you've highlighted there. I think one, yeah, it is a lot more concertinas towards the bottom division this season compared to last season, which kind of gives you hope if you're stuck in the bottom three places, because you think, you know, we're only one win away from pulling yourself out to mid-table and having a bit of gap there. So I think it is different from last season in that respect as well. I think also, I mean, from Everton's perspective, I agree with you. I think that there's a root out of the difficulties at the moment. I think the experience of last season really should count for quite a bit, because they knew what they needed. They got the benefits of knowing what got them over the line last season, and you kind of hope and think that, you know, they've learned from that and they'll be able to utilise that. I think the key thing for all those teams down the bottom is whether you've got a match winner, as in a goal scorer in your team, who can get you a result when you least expect it. I think part of the reason why Everton said it last season, in addition to these kind of having to fight the way out, was the goals of Richarlison, and they've never really replaced the loss of Richarlison. And you know, whether Calvert-Lewin can return to full fitness, you know, whether they can bring another experienced striker, which Everton's looking to do, I don't know, but that's been a key loss. But I think if you can, you know, somehow get the goals that you need, that's going to make a difference keeping you up. Look at the teams down there. Yeah, I mean, there's a number of teams that could find themselves in an unhealthy position in about, you know, as the season draws to its conclusion. I do worry for Southampton, because I just don't think, you know, Nathan Jones has had the kind of new manager boost that you'd kind of expect initially. I do have concerns about Leeds United, because I all have the feeling that Jesse Marsh is about to explode and spontaneously combust on the touchline at any given moment in time during a game. I'm not totally convinced by his tactics, but to be fair, some of the scoring goals at the moment, Patrick Bamford might come back, so that can make a huge difference then. West Ham just seems to be on a very downward slope at the moment, that maybe, you know, Moyes, he might have just been there one season too long. I don't know. Has he kind of lost the ability to motivate the team? That certainly would be a concern as a West Ham fan. And I'd also, as a Bournemouth fan, be hugely concerned with their situation, because apart from the league win that Everton gifted them, their recent run of form doesn't inspire any encouragement. And although they have this new American owner who's saying he's going to come and invest all this money, there aren't that many, you know, key players who are going to be available in the January transfer window to change your season. So I think that they're in quite a difficult position as well. And you mentioned before this, Steve, well, I mean, Leicester, you look at Leicester's squad and think, you know, this team should not be in the situation that they are. They've got talent running throughout the team, but every time I watch them, defensively, they're just so disorganised. They don't mark a set pieces. They don't pick players up. Now, those two horrific own goals they scored at Anfield the other week were kind of indicative of the kind of haphazard defending that's kind of characterised their team this season. So I'm not totally convinced that Leicester are in the clear at the moment. As ever, the key thing would be, you know, when the teams play each other, you know, Everton play Southampton next Saturday. That's a massive win for both teams. A loss there for Everton, I think Lampard's gone. I don't think that they can afford, you know, a defeat to the team at the bottom of the table again. And similarly, you know, if Everton were to win that game, then suddenly Southampton get a bit cut off, and you know, they might be like in a Norwich type situation if they just start putting some wins on the board. But having said that, they beat Palace in the cup on Saturday, so maybe that they might just be getting something together. I'm not quite sure, but. It's good as a neutral. It's going to be absolutely compelling stuff to see how the season pans out. There are going to be some upsets, you know, between now and the curtailments of the season. And obviously, I'd much prefer not to be in that situation. But like you, Stephen, I think I can see a way out for Everton. And yeah, it is only 18 games into the season, not 20 games to play. A lot can change. I also think as well, the World Cup factor impact is going to have a big effect in the second half of the season. I mean, Gary, you aligned with Chan off air before about the injuries that Chelsea has suffered. I think all those teams down that end of the table, there's going to be, you know, maybe a loss of a key player at a really crucial time, an injury that's going to derail the plans that the team has. So I think that that's going to be quite an important factor as well. And I don't want to be in that situation, but obviously, as I can understand, you know, for the general footballing public, if you're looking for a intriguing sort of finale to the season, but the one is definitely in the making there.
Oh, definitely. I think one of the big things is for the current bottom three are better off points wise than last season's bottom three at this point. You know, and like I say, upwards of Leicester holding on to 13th are worse off than last season's 13th place side at this point last season. So that concertina is just absolutely stunning. But this season, Watford hadn't introduced themselves as the Watford that they would be for the rest of the season. You know, I think they won two, maybe three games at the most from this point to the end of the campaign. Now, Gary, do you see kind of like any potential Watford at this point? You know, is there anyone that looks a likely suspect?
Yeah, I think it's Chelsea. I mean, you know, he's at 13th. I mean, Chelsea 10th now. And I mentioned you guys off air during the Man City game, the league game in midweek. Stat was given out that Chelsea have the least shots and least shots on target of any club in the Premier League this season. It would just look like coming to Barnda with a banjo at the moment. I mean, I'm only semi-serious, but I'm a little bit serious. But I mean, sort of look at the teams that are sort of struggling at the bottom now. I mean, I think Southampton are in real trouble. And I think Nottingham Forest have had a bit of a rally, but I just think they're still got a strange hodgepodge of players there that have been sort of thrown together almost like, you know, put anything in the jar and mixed up and hope for the best. So, I mean, I would sort of say Southampton and Forest are probably in trouble. And the other one I would say is West Ham. They seem to be bereft of inspiration at the moment. You know, managers can't beat a club too long. You know, players have heard all the things you've got to say and you can't inspire anymore, can't motivate anymore. And yet they've got some really good players at the Scamacca, the Italian guy. They've got Declan Rice, you know, that team with sort of those sort of players. Paqueta, played for Brazil. A team like that should not be in that situation. So there's something not quite right there. I do worry for Everton as well. I mean, I think Lampard will get the Evo, if not next week, the week after or the week after. It ain't going to be too long. The big thing will be who they put in instead. I mean, there's talk about Rooney. I mean, I'm not sure that's a brilliant decision. I mean, I don't know. We'll see. I mean, obviously, the club down there, like Wolves, but I think they've made a good decision with getting rid of Bruno Lage, who was a bit of a weird appointment anyway, and gone for a guy with real talent, Lopetegui, who is, I think the players, he's been there five games, and I think they've won three, drew one, lost one. And we're unlucky not to get to not Liverpool at the FA Cup. So I think they've probably got a chance, and they'll spend a bit of dosh bringing in Cunha, the Brazilian striker from Atletico Madrid. So I think they'll probably be okay. But I say Southampton and Forest, I worry about. I think West Ham could be the other one to go down.
Can I throw one team in there, Stephen? That bottom 13 downwards at the moment. I just worry about Crystal Palace. Like, you can't look at some of their recent results.
Wheels have fallen off of it, haven't they?
Yeah, 4-0 home to Tottenham, 3-0 home to Fulham. They lost away in Nottingham Forest. It's not a great vein of form on that, except they've got points in the bags, and then the challenge for the other teams is to reclaim those points on the ball. If I was a Crystal Palace fan, I'd just be looking kind of nervous, the almost sure thing. We just maybe need, you know, to make sure we don't drop points to teams below us as the season progresses, because you know, when you've lost your last two home games, you haven't scored, and you conceded seven goals, it does kind of raise a few concerns, I would say. And I think, you know, it's a common thing that, you know, our Palace too over-reliant on Wolf and Zaha. You know, if he were to sustain injury in the second half of the season, where does that lead? I'm not quite sure. I could be doing Palace total disservice here. I apologise if I am. But they're the only, because I think you mentioned before, Stephen, you know, like Watford last season weren't, but didn't look hugely in danger at this stage. But most seasons, there tends to be a team that gets caught up unexpectedly in that sort of maelstrom at the bottom. So if one team was to do that from teams, well, it won't be Chelsea, Gary, but I think it's Crystal Palace, possibly.
You're right, it does happen. You know, a club looks at its next fixtures and they find they've got, you know, Arsenal away, Newcastle, Liverpool, Manchester United, and Man City, and you think, you know, all of a sudden, five games drift away, you get 1 point, and you're in disaster trouble.
Indeed, and vulnerable as well is always the teams that came up as well. You know, I think Fulham are playing exceptionally well You know, you got to take your hat off for a team that have just yo-yoed perpetually for the best part of a decade now. You know, too good for the Championship, not good enough for the Premier League to, I don't know, be confounding all expectations and turning kind of like convention on its head. You know, I think of all the teams, you know, in the Premier League, from left field, shall we say, I think Fulham are the ones that, you know, need a huge amount of kudos. But, you know, Brentford as well.
Oh, Brentford,
you know, amazing. Played spectacular well. But yeah, you know, going back to West Ham, for instance, you know, I think a lot of West Ham's problems rest within the fact that the suffering, that kind of hangover effect. You know, they got to the semi-finals of the Europa League, were seen as favourites to make the final when going up against Eintracht Frankfurt, which was a mad thing, really, considering that Frankfurt had won the Pokal, you know, the previous season, and just that typical kind of English, lazy English kind of attitude that, you know, the Premier League's the place, and of course that means that, you know, the representatives will sweep all aside. But, you know, a lot of people kind of like back West Ham to reach that final a year ago, and I think there was, I don't know, because there was that, I don't know, that spring in the step, and then suddenly it was kind of like stopped. I think they have kind of struggled to shake the disappointment of that. But whether or not, you know, I think they've got enough talent to snap to. But you're saying the same about Leicester City, you know, and some of the incredible players that they've got at their disposal, yet they are struggling. You know, it's no guarantee. But, you know, yeah, I think Gary's right with Southampton. You know, they've got a big month ahead. And Nottingham Forest and Bournemouth, you know, have to look over the shoulder, just because of the weight of football and gravity, and the, you know, of the three teams that come up from the Championship to the Premier League, it's very unusual that any more than one survive that first season, which, you know, gives you more hope there as well, Paul.
Thanks for that, Steve. It's always reassuring to have your analysis of our situation.
I think we'd like to call this a bit of a therapy session.
Indeed.
Oh, excellent stuff. Yeah. Oh, just one last thing. I think we'll all have a quick nod at our FA Cup non-exploits this weekend. Paul, that was always going to be a difficult task for you on Friday night at Manchester United, who have hit a bit of I'd like to think temporary fall.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it was the best performance, Stephen. You know, one very, very close VAR decision went against us, which could have changed the match. And I mean, it's a discussion point for a time in the future, but I couldn't believe that the match experts were criticising Damari Gray for making the run too quickly, because these days, you're on forward, you're getting judged by laser precision as to whether you're offside or not. So it must be impossible when you're looking along the line to think, oh, is my toe offside here? Is my elbow offside? Is my finger offside? It's really difficult for forward in that situation. But yeah, going back to the game, yeah, I think my son went to the game, so his view was most fans were very supportive of the manager and of the team, a much better performance. And I think, as you hinted at before there, Stephen, maybe the way for Everton to get out of this situation is back five, you know, solid lineup, and see where that gets them. But yeah, frustrating nonetheless. And we've had some incredibly bad luck with our third rounds over the past few seasons.
Oh, haven't you just? And Gary, that was a sobering experience today for Chelsea.
Yeah, I mean, for sort of, I don't know, 20 minutes or so, I think we played, it was pretty even. Once Morris scored, you could see where he's going to go. Brilliant free kick by Morris, by the way, what a goal. Yeah, but we've got so many players out. I counted before the kickoff, about 12, what you consider first team players out injured. Not that that's any excuse, it's just a fact. But we played City in both cups, both times, which is interesting. You know, I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying Chelsea are a big club. I'm not saying they're a big club, but, you know, they've won the cup in the past. We're out. The odds are City are going to end up playing Arsenal in the next round, so one of them are going out. Liverpool were fairly fortunate, shall we say, to get a replay. The goal that wasn't a goal. I mean, I've seen a steal. I mean, it's fascinating.
No, I mean, I was my seat was right in line with that, and I had no idea what they when they said there was a VAR check.
Yeah,
I was totally nonplussed by it. Within that, I did actually think the second one was offside. I've seen it on the telly since, and it wasn't. He was just onside, but to the naked eye, that second Wolves goal, you know, looked offside at the time. which you know, we looked at a much closer call. There was just absolutely no, you know, no sense in that third goal. You know, on initial view.
When the ball was heading back to the corner taker, it was Nunes, I think. The line up on the far side flagged for offside.
Now, he flagged for offside in that.
But when it went to VAR, apparently VAR said we haven't got a camera in the sufficient angle to judge whether he's offside or not. Now, I don't understand the logic of that. What if not? If you haven't got a camera in position to judge an offside, where the hell are your bloody cameras? I mean, isn't that what it's there for? So Mike Reid was doing not the comedian, although perhaps he was a bit of a comedian. He got back to the referee and said, we can't see anything to overrule, suggesting we should overrule the decision. And apparently that's why it stood. But nobody, there's been no sort of discussion or controversy that I can see or hear or read that says, what the hell were VAR doing without a camera that could judge an offside decision? I mean, apparently, Lopetegui had got what they call a tactical camera. I'm not really sure what that means. But they got it on film and they could see it wasn't offside. Now, I haven't seen that video. I've seen it still. Well, it doesn't look offside, but that's difficult to tell because of the flow of the game and where the ball was and when the contact was and such like. But I think the big issue here is perhaps not whether it was a goal or not, is what was VAR doing not having a camera to judge offside? Am I missing something?
It's like switching off the magic eye at Wimbledon, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Just give the box a kick as you're running into the net.
What are you there for? I mean, literally, what are you there for? If your camera's not in the right position, does somebody always have the backside kicked? I mean, I don't know whether it'll cost it, you know, balls or anything, whether it should have been a goal or I don't know because I haven't seen any video of it. But I think that the key issue is how did VAR, the setup of VAR, not have a camera there to judge offside? Because 90% of the decisions they make are offside, they're line decisions. And I said, what?
Things, two things, like Gary. If I was Jurgen Klopp, I'd be identifying that part of the ground to make sure if we're offside here, no one's going to spot us. So let's use that in home games. But because it's common knowledge that there's a blind spot in the stadium, so surely someone's going to take advantage of that at some stage in the forthcoming fixtures, unless that's rectified. And secondly, I mean, why is VAR not used at all the grounds in the third round of the FA Cup? I know the argument is because lower league teams haven't got it. In that case, why not just not use VAR in the third round?
I think we had it in the League Cup when we played at Man City. There was no VAR that night. Right that if VAR isn't available at all grounds during a certain round, then or certainly up to a certain round. I mean, if a team reaches the fifth round or whatever, a quarter final, and they've not got VAR implemented at the ground, then fair enough. But I think at the third round stage, you know, if it's not available at a certain high percentage of grounds, then it shouldn't be on at any of the grounds at all.
It's interesting. I wonder if, and this is a bit sort of, you know, a what if question, if Lopetegui had took his, it's like an iPad of some description, I suppose, to the fourth official and said, look, here's the proof he wasn't offside. Would the official be allowed to take that information, that evidence on board?
I don't think so.
Why not?
No, I agree.
The question is why or why not? I don't know it because it's factual.
He probably gets done by the FA for disrepute, bringing the game into disrepute.
Yeah. Well, probably, but why? If it's the truth. I mean, it's not like, oh, I didn't think it was a foul. It's not. There's none of that. It's not an opinion. If it's black and white and you can prove that it wasn't offside, I don't know if it was. But if it was, I mean, this is just a bit theoretical.
The next step for football is kind of like the dodgy goals panel and stuff like that. You know, it's taking the game into a committee meeting, you know, 72 hours after the event and being awarded a winning goal 3 days after the match was actually taking place.
Yeah.
It's the next illogical step for football. Yeah.
I think once you open the door to technology, it's always going to be not how far do you go, it's how far before you stop. That's going to be the problem.
Oh, interesting. Definitely. Well, fellas, it's been a great hour and 20 minutes chatting. Thanks, Paul. Brilliant topics as always.
Thanks, Stephen. Always a pleasure being on the show and you're hosting for us. Thanks for giving us all the chance to speak and raise our point. And I loved your background on a Panathinaikos there. Good to see one of the old Greek giants, European giants, come back to the fore again. Excellent stuff. And Gary, quick, your tribute to Vialli was simply superb. You really did the man justice. Thank you.
Yeah, and thanks, Gary, for everything. The brilliant words about Jean-Luc Vialli earlier on.
Yeah, gratitude. You can't beat talking about your football with your mates on a Sunday evening. The best of times. Oh, even respect the ale.
No wine's like Gary.
No, I've got a cold, so I'm off.
It's on the Lenser.
Yeah, cheers, guys.
Brilliant. Thank you for listening. This has been The Lob by These Football Times. Thank you and good night.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.